This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on Sunday, the 18th of November 2012. The Monocle Weekly is brought to you in association with Tourism Australia. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly, episode 176, with me, Tom Edwards, and Andrew Tuck.
On the show today, we'll be debating the UK's role in an information gathering technique that we apparently don't condone or practice, torture. Author and journalist Ian Cobain will be lifting the lid on the UK's secrets.
We'll be heading to the zoo after that and speaking to a law professor who's turned her expertise to the day-to-day running of animal parks. Iris Braverman will be discussing her book Zooland a little later.
And we'll speak to Poppy Burton Morgan, director of a new play in London that tells the real-life stories of those caught in the Arab Spring and its surrounding events.
All that, plus perhaps a tune or two, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Well, there's revolving chairs, aren't there? Not just in the studio, I mean in life.
Because
it's you and me. It's Tom and Andrew.
I like to look at us as, you know, maybe the dream team, Andrew.
You're sitting in the big chair?
I'm in the big chair. I think it fits pretty well.
You look very good in the big chair.
I do my
and,
best.
And you're also going to be still doing Tom's Look Ahead.
That's right. I like to do my crystal ball gazing each week.
Will you stay in the big chair or are you going to go back to the little stool?
I feel I need to go back to my small childlike seat for that segment.
Okay, well, I'm looking forward to that. Now, let's be honest. We're about the only two people left in Midori House this week.
It's been a funny week, hasn't it? Some of the places, we've been sending our many talented and able editorial staff to all corners, as we always do here at Monocle.
You and me have been we've been to the Nordic region, but the Nordic bakery to
exactly.
get coffee. That's as far as we've gone. But we've had Steve Bloomfield in the real Nordic region. He's been up in the Arctic Circle. So Sophie Grove, I guess, just south of the Arctic Circle. She's been in Reykjavik, which I think is not quite as north as the Arctic Circle.
Probably still a bit brisk though up there, I reckon.
Yes, I think she's going to be in a big down coat. That's how I envisage her anyway. Envisage? That's how I see her in my mind. And Danny and Adrian have been in Rome. Everyone's been somewhere except you and me.
I know, I have to start asking, what have I done wrong?
Now, we've got quite a serious show ahead, I think.
It has some serious elements, but I think it's important to do that every now and again, Andrew, to look at the more serious stories that sometimes are brushed aside on the news agenda because they're rather difficult to deal with, but, they need our attention.
Yeah, we're going to be looking at Arab Spring, we're going to be talking torture, and
a trip to the zoo, though.
And a trip to the zoo. That might be quite nice.
Could be a bit of fun there.
Have you ever been to London Zoo?
I'm quite a fan, actually. Recently,
quite a fan?
Well, no, they initiated a Zoo Lates initiative. Are you familiar
okay.
with this?
No.
So you can head along in the evening, after hours, the kids have gone, maybe have a tiger beer. See, tiger beer. It's clever. Or, a glass of wine. Stroll amongst the...
Do they let you wander around with a glass of wine?
Yeah. You can take a picnic in there. It's
oh
pretty
God.
Good. They have some concessions. You can buy a sandwich, for example.
You can buy a chimp.
You can buy. Yeah, they don't let you take the animals home. I did try, but I was stopped from doing so. But no, that's a really wonderful experience.
I went a couple of years ago to London Zoo, and my favourite bit was Nocturnal World. Did you go there?
That's
it's
good.
All underground, all dark.
But it was all nocturnal because it was the evening.
Of course. Were the giraffes in bed?
Were they
in their very big pyjamas?
They were resting. Okay. A massive nightcap. But a number of the creatures, because it's sort of dusk time, that's when they come out and roam around and get a bit more expressive. See, the gorilla exhibit, for example, came alive at dusk.
Oh, my God. Our evenings are sorted because we're not far from London Zoo.
Oh, you've got to stop by.
I'll come up with you for a nice glass of wine and to see a chimp. any day.
What better evening can you paint than that?
Actually, it's not much different than being in this bloody office. Anyway. We're going to have Tom's crystal balls, but we're going to have to stop for a second because it's going to be just after this. And you know what comes next? It's Tom Edwards and his magical balls staring into the future, polished crystal balls. Telling us everything that's in the week ahead.
I like to gaze within into the crystal ball and see what's happening, setting the news agenda, if you will, for the week ahead.
Are we going to start perky, or are we going to be depressed from the word go?
No, I think we'll start with good hard news.
Go for it.
So tomorrow on Monday, in Germany, the Bundestag will vote on the next Greek bailout installment. Now, maybe a little dry, but I think this is of fundamental importance. So basically, this will establish whether or not they agree to grant Greece more time to meet these loan conditions, which will then clear the way for this next bailout installment. Obviously, Antonis Samaras, the Greek Prime Minister, had hoped that payment would all be cleared earlier from a meeting of European finance ministers. But it's kind of contingent on some of the national parliaments agreeing to sort of rubber stamp it. So plenty at stake. And obviously, Greece is really on the cusp of possibly even kind of running out of cash reserves sometime this month. So it's of fundamental importance.
You say rubber stamp. Do we think that the Germans have, no choice really but to give it the green light?
Well, it's this classic problem, I think, that it always comes back to fundamentally, you know, is the German appetite for the European project as strong as it was? And there's certainly every sign that from, you know, Angela Merkel through to, you know, even amongst most people, there's still this appetite to, you know, to keep driving it through. So, I mean, my anticipation would be that it's passed without...
But interesting that tension there, because, you know, the Greeks are sitting there in Athens waiting to see whether Berlin will allow them to continue governing.
That's essentially it, yeah. So you're looking at these nations that are completely almost, you know, in the thrall to another. And I'm pretty sure no one, when they were fashioning how the European Union would work on a governmental level, ever thought or wanted that to happen.
Okay, some tough news. But so tomorrow the Greeks and the Germans have got a few things to sort out between themselves.
That's right.
And then next?
Well, I thought we'd spin across the globe. Keeping it tomorrow, keeping it Monday, start of the week, Barack Obama will be meeting his counterpart in Burma and will also be meeting Aung San Suu Kyi. Now, obviously, this is interesting because it's a further endorsement of, you know, the reformist efforts that Burma's making. And, you know, Obama is in Southeast Asia. There's a ASEAN, Southeast Asian Nations meeting. He's talked very much about the pivot in US policy towards the Far East and Southeast Asia, Oceania, and that kind of thing. But there'll also be some resistance because, you know, does it still seem to some people, there's still quite a organised protest movement in Burma, there's a lot of opposition activists who will be perhaps concerned that this is a too explicit an endorsement of, you know, the regime there, which, whilst it's made notable efforts to be more accommodating, to be more democratic, they feel a very long way to go. So, you know, is it good press to see Obama, you know, rolling into town?
Can I give you a footnote?
Absolutely.
Everyone's interested to know, actually, what he'll call the country when he gets there. Because Thane's saying that the president has said, as, you know, part of the, you know, him kind of managing to negotiate the country along this path towards democracy, that the government would like Obama to call it Myanmar or Myanmar. Either way, one or the other, they'd be happy with. And Aung San Suu Kyi, who clings to the idea of Burma, because that's the name prior to the military regime, she wants him to... Well, is it unsure that maybe she might be giving way. But apparently, in the past, when American officials have gone there, they've quite deliberately never said the name of where they are.
This is what I wondered. I wondered whether you could... It's almost like one of those sort of pub games. Can you get through an entire state visit never referring to your host at all by name?
Yeah.
Tricky, I would say.
Well, apparently plenty of people have been there from the US administration and not said where they are.
Well, if anyone can do it, Barack Obama can do it, sure.
I know, I think he's clever. I think he could do that party trick. go, Barack, go. We're going to be counting the hours.
It's one to watch.
It's intriguing.
Now, I think let's lighten the tone slightly. On Wednesday, now every now and again there's these sort of international days, you know, for different issues. Different sort of minority groups, some very, very noble, some quite challenging. It's one of my favourites on Wednesday. It's World Television Day.
Oh, that's nice.
How do you feel about that?
I think I might participate.
Well, this is the thing. I'm already planning to be watching some television that day to do my bit.
What the hell is World Television Day?
So it was established by the United Nations, no less, in 1996... in recognition of the growing impact of television on decision-making, as television was increasingly alerting the world to conflicts and threats to peace and security.
Just 50 years late.
It's a tad late.
You can imagine, like, kind of 2040, they'll have Internet Day.
Very possibly. But I don't know. I think that's nice. Like, you know, it's a medium. Now, obviously, we'd all probably be in broad agreement on Monocle 24 that, you know, radio is, you know, the spoken word. It's the finest communications medium. But there's still a small space, I feel, for television.
Apparently, it was only 1994 that they introduced Papyrus Day as well. They wanted to look at the impact that scrolls were having on the world.
Well, maybe there is a Scroll Day.
I bet there is.
I'll look into it. But I think that's interesting, World Television Day. And I'll be celebrating it by watching. I still have a cathode ray tube television. No flat panels for me.
You can't afford one, or?
Well, it's...
You like to pretend it's 1940.
It's a little bit of that, yeah.
Okay.
It's a, you know, it's next to my steam radio.
Let me see the powers that be. I think we can get you a raise at Christmas so you can have a proper telly. Beautiful. Is it black and white or colour?
It is colour. I've eased myself into the 1980s, yeah.
So, shall we leave it there and have a show?
I think we should get on with the show.
Right, okay, we'll be back right after this.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, this is Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe, top.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
With no end in sight to the so-called war on terror, sadly, we hear more and more claims of Britain's participation in questionable interrogation techniques that detention camps such as Guantanamo Bay have made infamous. But that word, torture, is not something any government is keen to acknowledge.
Our first guest, the investigative journalist and author Ian Cobain, says that torture is nothing new in the UK. His new book, Cruel Britannia, looks back over the conflicts of the 20th century right up to the present day to show that Britain's use of torture should shock, but unfortunately not surprise us.
Ian, thank you very much for coming in to see us. It's a remarkable book, but I think one of the most interesting questions that it throws up is a question you almost ask yourself, which is about what it means in a way to be British, because you have this idea at the beginning of the book that your country is not a country that would partake really in this idea of torture. But in fact, you trace its history, particularly from the Second World War on, and it's a long and not very distinguished history that runs throughout our political life. Could you tell us, did it make you question something about your national identity, your sense of being British?
It did. There was a time when I assumed, I like to think I've never been entirely complacent about our liberties, but there was a time when I assumed that the British really didn't do torture, that because it would somehow be un-British to do so. And when I realised that not only since 9/11 have we been really quite readily involved in rendition and torture, but that actually it goes a lot further back, that these problems didn't start with 9/11, then it was something of an eye-opener. And I'm hoping the book is something of an eye-opener. I start at 1940, but of course I could have started a lot further back if I'd wanted to. You know, how much further would you want to go? 1940 seemed like a good enough time to start for me.
In the beginning of the book and the end of the book, you're looking at the story of a young British Muslim who has been picked up in Pakistan and has been both tortured by the Pakistanis and also by British intelligence officers who have, or allegedly by British intelligence officers.
Well, no, since 9/11, the British wouldn't dirty their own hands with this. They didn't actually engage directly in the torture, although they have engaged directly in the interrogations in which torture has been involved, by supplying questions. So they wouldn't actually be in the room.
So this is the outsourcing of this kind of...
Outsourcing, or the good old British term, subcontracting. instructions were issued in early 2002 to MI5 and MI6 officers in the field that they must not be seen to condone torture, but that they had no legal obligation to intervene to prevent it. And once those instructions were in place and were received and understood, that meant that British intelligence officers could submit questions to be put to individuals by overseas agencies known to use torture. They could quite literally stand outside the room and hand the questions in, as long as they weren't involved and being seen to condone it.
And just before I pass on to Tom, but your initial question when you have this meeting with the lawyer, and which sets you off in a sense to write this book, was it that you were surprised about the amount of torture that was going on and you just felt it needed to be explained? What was the kind of impetus for making this into a book?
Well, I came across one case in which an individual said that they'd been tortured repeatedly over a period of 10 months, and in between torture sessions, they would be asked questions over a glass of water by a couple of British intelligence officers. This was in Pakistan. Then I came across a second case, then a third case, then a fourth case, all very similar, all British Muslims, all alleged jihadists or terrorists, and in some cases since convicted of terrorism offences, all saying that they were tortured in Pakistan, and in between torture sessions, they would be questioned by British people. And at that point, I realised that there was a pattern, clearly, and the pattern suggested a policy. So I thought, well, is there a policy? Is there a secret government policy that's leading to people being tortured? And that's one of the things I decided I wanted to try to find out.
Yeah, it's quite interesting about that idea of a policy, a systematic use of this as a strategy, because one of the points you make in the book is how varied the success can be of using this, using torture in any of its forms. Obviously, there have been some convictions, as you mentioned there, post 9/11, which I guess you could argue has delivered a result. But going right back, to say World War II, how successful has this really been for Britain in instances where it does appear to have been utilised?
Well, unfortunately, I'm not one of those people who thinks that torture doesn't work, because it's used for a whole variety of different reasons. People assume it's used to extract information. But during the Second World War, the British used it not so much to extract information, but to secure the transfer of loyalties, as they would have put it at that time. So they'd have in their custody somebody who's working for the Nazis, and they would make sure that within a very short period of time they were prepared to work for the British and wouldn't consider working for the Nazis ever again because of the way they were treated. It's also on occasions used to intimidate. It can clearly intimidate an individual, but it can intimidate a wider group of people, a community, even entire societies. And also it's been used in Northern Ireland in living memory in order to extract so-called confessions that could be put before a court and could secure a conviction of a terrorism suspect and ensure that they were locked away for a very long period of time.
But its effectiveness, as Tom was hinting there, I know that a couple of little instances here when you're talking about the Second World War, you say that, in fact, of all the people that were turned by the British, the Nazis, as far as we know, none of them were actually double agenting against us. They all did actually come over to our side and worked very well. But then in the example of Northern Ireland, you do say that it's not so effective because it ignored the really kind of deep-seated history in Ireland, and that's the link it couldn't break.
Trying to use it to deal with deal with what was effectively an insurgency within the UK's territory, I think it was disastrous. It was employed first by torture was employed briefly in 1971 by the British Army. And I mean torture, I don't mean the odd beating, I mean systematic use of techniques which had been developed over decades. And it didn't work then. As the army took a step backwards in the mid-1970s and handed over to the Royal Ulster Constabulary, the police came under pressure to obtain confessions that could be used in courts. I know a number of people who were involved in this work, and they thought in the mid-1970s that it was working very well. They thought that they had the paramilitaries beaten, and by the late 1970s, they'd realised it had been entirely counterproductive, and what they had been doing in places like Castlereagh had actually prolonged the conflict. That's the view that they now take.
I'm interested in some of the personalities, if you like. Obviously, it requires a certain mindset to go along with a system of interrogation or running of a prison department, whatever it would be, where, torture or other similar sort of tactics, strategies are employed. There are some interesting examples in the book, obviously, particularly in the Second World War. There's these particular characters who seem to have a mastery, if you like, of the techniques and strategies of torture. Do you think it is something that depends upon specific personalities to actually get to actually deliver results? Or is it something where you can have a policy and that it can be equally effective?
Well, that's a very good question. It's difficult to be sure. I would have thought that I'd like to think that most people would not engage in this sort of activity, regardless of what they thought the stakes to be, and regardless of what sort of orders they felt themselves to be under. But it's entirely possible that a great many people could find themselves involved in this. I know that again, with the reference to Northern Ireland, the people who I know were involved in these sort of matters took the view that what they were trying to do was use violence to suppress an even greater violence. They were trying to save lives. They were hurting people, but they were trying to save lives. That's the way they justified it. to themselves in the Second World War, of course. There was a period when we really started getting into the torture business in 1940 when the future of the nation appeared to be at stake. We thought we were about to be invaded. And I think a great many people at that time would think that it would be surprising and somewhat amiss even if the British authorities didn't resort to whatever was necessary.
And without getting too colourful, what is torture?
Well, if you talk to a... There are people who've told me, I won't name names, but there's a minister from the last government who was very much involved in giving permissions to the agencies to get involved in activities that resulted in people getting hurt, who'd say, well, there's a difference between torture on the one hand and cruel, inhuman and degrading treatment on the other. Presumably a lawyer, a government lawyer, had told him this. I've never yet come across anybody other than those who are involved in its use to make that distinction. Those people who are on the receiving end certainly don't. I've never heard of I know a few people who are in the IRA, and none of them have ever said to me, well, when I was in Castlereagh, I was never tortured. I was just subjected to a bit of the old cruel, inhuman and degrading. Because that distinction's maybe a nice, fine, legalistic one, but it means nothing to anybody other than a lawyer. The UN Convention Against Torture describes it as extreme physical or psychological pain applied by a government official.
And lots of this is psychological, isn't it? Because many of the things you're talking about, there's no hand being laid on a person. It's deprivation, it's noise, it's disturbing your sleep patterns.
The British developed between the 1945 and 1970 what were known as formally as the five aids, the five techniques in aid of interrogation. The five techniques in aid of interrogation. The greatest pain involved in that was through the use of stress positions, and they realised that pain which was self-inflicted was that much more damaging and broke a man down far more quickly than pain that was inflicted from without. And on top of that, there would be sleep deprivation, noise, starvation, and hooding. They also realised that the use of a hood tended to exacerbate all of the other effects.
It's pretty harrowing stuff. I just wondered, bringing it right up to date, we've obviously seen in the case of Abu Qatada this week, this refusal to extradite him because he may face these kinds of treatments that we're talking about. Do you think that reflects sort of some kind of hypocrisy almost, I guess, by the British government? Or do you think that actually that reflects more closely what the British ideals actually are? And as you've pointed out, sometimes it's just been historic circumstances that have kind of driven us to do these things.
I can see how the courts might find it difficult to sanction the deportation of Abu Qatada, given the risk that he faces in Jordan. What's happened in recent years is the courts, when faced with allegations that an individual has been mistreated before being put on trial in the UK, they've tended to reach judgments that have allowed trials of individuals to go ahead. They're very reluctant to scrap a trial on the basis that the proceeding would be amount to an abuse of the process of the court, despite there being clear evidence. For example, I remember 4 years ago watching a man going on trial at Manchester Crown Court minus three of his fingernails after he'd spent 13 months in Pakistan before being deported, not extradited, deported to the UK to be put on trial.
It is extraordinary how that narrative of torture pops up in all sorts of stories this week. There was the stories I was watching about the Neil Haywood case and about people there confessing, you know, after being put in again in stress positions for torture. It's it is used by all governments, and you said you're not somebody who believes it doesn't work. Do you think it is a tool that governments should have at their use?
No, I think it's it has to be described as morally reprehensible, and there has to be an absolute prohibition in law. For that prohibition to really be absolute, of course, there has to be consequences, legal consequences, for those who do get involved. The alternative is it's too difficult to contemplate. If you were to permit it, how would you regulate it? How would you decide how much pain an individual could be put through? To what end? And would you allow? Well, if you're going to allow counter-terrorism officials to use it, would you also allow people involved in attempting to prevent nuclear proliferation to use it? What about detectives who are trying to find a serial killer? And as I say, how would you regulate? How would you legislate for it? You'd have to introduce legislation for it. I can't see how that can possibly be done.
Just wondered, you mentioned there some conversations you'd had with ministers or recently serving ministers. How do you gauge the reaction of the sort of political establishment in this country currently? Do you think there's still that, you know, the defence of the realm first, that kind of attitude prevails to the extent where people will turn a blind eye still? Or do you sense a genuine appetite to move beyond the sort of era where this was acceptable in any circumstances?
I think there was, with the formation of the coalition government, a desire to move beyond the worst excesses of the past. And I think that there was a genuine horror on the part of people who were coming into government in 2010 when they realised what had actually been happening in the name of the British government and the British people. How long that resolve can be maintained, I don't really know. I mean, with the Foreign Secretary has in so many words said that we're moving on, but he adds he will have to continue to make some very difficult decisions in the interests of the British people and the British state. I think that there is probably less enthusiasm for its use, a lot less, not least because people like myself have really figured out what they've been doing and exposed it, and it's whilst it may have a utility, it's also I think it's seen as being shameful, and it's still possible that there could be legal consequences.
Well, it's not always an easy read, but it's undeniably compelling. It's Cruel Britannia, A Secret History of Torture. Ian Cobain, thanks very much for coming to speak to us on Monocle 24.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Monocle Weekly with me, Tom Edwards, and Andrew Tuck. We'll be going to the zoo right after this.
Tully Kadar, a barista at Mecca Espresso in stunning Sydney, can't decide between the incredible warmth of the people and the outstanding beauty of the scenery when it comes to what makes life in Australia such a daily delight.
We have beautiful weather, a lovely culture, a unique sense of humour. Quality of life is just very high, and I'm very proud of the Aussie culture. I like our matter-of-factness. I feel like we have sort of a good balance between the outgoing, almost ostentatious American style and the very reserved British sensibility. I feel like we kind of land a healthy balance, and the culture's pretty cool.
There's nothing like Australia.
Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly with me, Tom Edwards, and Andrew Tuck.
As children, a visit to the zoo is one of life's great wonders. But as we learn a little more about the world, the magic of the zoo transforms slightly. It becomes an odd place where many animals just don't seem to be where they belong, out in the wild.
Our next guest, Professor Iris Braverman, is a specialist in law, anthropology, and geography, and combined those passions into a new book focusing on zoos. Zooland looks at the day-to-day tasks of keeping zoos, and more importantly, their animals, healthy and happy.
Iris joins us on the line now from Buffalo, New York. Iris, thank you very much for joining us. Could you just tell us why you decided to write this book? What was your feeling about zoos? Because I think you're trying to balance a very careful line. You're not saying they're terrible places, or you're not saying they're great places. You're trying to kind of explain a little bit the mechanics behind the zoo in a way.
What got me started was my daughter, actually. She just turned 2, and she took me to the zoo. And I was very curious. I haven't been to a zoo for many years, maybe 20, 30 years, since I was probably very young. And it just raised a lot of emotional things for me, and I decided to explore it further. And so I took my students and discovered that it was a very complex enterprise, a very complex institution that fascinated me. So it was really a kind of open space of curiosity to figure out what exactly raises all these complex emotions and, you know, ambiguity about and ambivalence about this space. You know, on the one hand, a lot of curiosity and desire to see those animals, but then also some sadness about their captivity. So those were the initial emotions that triggered this.
At the top of the show, before you came on, me and Tom were actually talking about London Zoo and the fact that, you know, we both rather like it as a place. And exactly for those reasons, it's a place where you become divorced from the city. You slightly get lost in this kind of other extraordinary world. Now, the zoo has had a kind of changing role and function, and that is highlighted in your book. You know, I guess 100 years ago when London Zoo was, or more when London Zoo was opened, it was a place to see the fantastic and the weird. And it now presents itself as a place of conservancy and looking after the future of many endangered species. For you, are those important roles still for a zoo, or are you less concerned about those elements and more about how it kind of functions in a way with us, the humans?
Yeah, my book explores the shifts that have occurred in zoos in the last several decades, and from places of, say, entertainment to the public, to places that now, especially accredited zoos around the world, are seeing themselves as places of conservation and a place where humans go basically to learn about the wild and to learn how to save it. And it's an interesting idea that through going to look at animals, you actually learn to care about them, and then through those animals that are depicted as ambassadors for their species in the wild, people will actually know about gorillas in the Congo and then go and save them. Otherwise, a lot of zoo professionals have told me, they were telling me, you know, without this, how can people actually learn to care about an animal that they've never seen or experienced with their own eyes? So this becomes a central theme for zoos today. They moved away from kind of just mere entertainment into seeing themselves as actually a place where they can care for animals, sometimes even animals that don't exist anymore in the wild, that do exist in captivity. And so so there's this notion of zoos as, say, arcs where animals can be saved. So those are some of the ideas. And I do think it's actually very relevant for zoos today. Zoos form this collaborative enterprise where they sit together in voluntary committees, decide how many gorillas, how many elephants, how many tigers are going to be raised in zoos all over, say, Europe, in the context of the European Association of Zoos and Aquariums, or North America, and then decide where exactly they're going to be raised, who's going to be who's going to reproduce with who, and where the offsprings are going to end up.
Could I just jump in there quickly with one little aside? You know, which this all sounds very appealing, but you know, there was an amazing report in the New York Times just a couple of months ago, which shone a kind of scary light on this process as well. They were saying that these zoos are so effective now at breeding animals that they breed too many of them, even endangered species, and also because they're so concerned that the gene pool is becoming diluted, that even for some protected species, for hippos, for example, they then euthanize the hippo children, or whatever you call a baby hippo when they're born. And they were also given the example of, you know, lions, for example. They allow lions to breed in captivity because they think it's good for the mothers to go through the experience of being a mother. But little does the mother know that actually after a few weeks they euthanize the cubs because there's just not the market for them. And I think that's what's scary for people outside of the zoo world. Yeah, there's this kind of veneer of, you know, conservation. But actually, the decision about what it's like to be those animals is controlled by a human, and decisions are being made on their behalf that actually feel a bit grotesque from the outside.
Well, that's a really good point. And actually, the narrative of zoos is that is exactly for reasons of conservation, because those tigers, for example, are hybrid tigers, and they want to save the species that are endangered. So exactly for that reason, there are priorities in zoos, so they have only limited space, and they must cull certain animals. So this is their perspective. Now, do we agree with that? That's another question. So again, certain animals are valorized more than others, and that's also an interesting aspect about zoos. Which animals do they promote? Which animals do people want to go? Which charismatic animals do they want to go and see? Usually not rats. Usually they want to see elephants and gorillas. And so what perception of nature, what perception of wilderness are we promoting here? So that's one question that I raise in the book.
Nora, so I was going to ask you one final question just about the gorilla. You mentioned how your book is a bookended with the tale of Timmy, this very famous gorilla. I just wondered, do you think that the way that animals are kind of anthropomorphized, you know, we get these personalities, these real characters that emerge, do you think that's helpful in terms of the zoo's getting their message out there to people? Or does it make it changes the animal from being this wild creature, something to be respected and understood, into a kind of weird amalgam where it becomes almost unreal or partially human? Is that actually helpful to develop that kind of relationship?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, and some zoo professionals kind of didn't like that I used the term pet animals when I used it initially. I'm not a zoo person, I'm not a zoologist. I came into this project as kind of a curious anthropologist and to look into it. So I just called it pet names, and they were very hurt. They call it house names, and this is the way that they want. So they have this kind of more scientific arrangement about it, and they, in addition to those house names, say Timmy, they have numbers for every animal, and they have databases, and every action of that animal is recorded and registered and documented, and then put up on a global database system. So alongside how they present the animal to the public, there's actually a much more intensive management and administrative system. And now that calling names was a really interesting enterprise, because there was a conflict at the Buffalo Zoo when a giraffe was born, and they wanted to call it after the daughter of then just elected President Obama, Malia. And there was an uproar in the African American community in the area, like, why call an animal, especially an animal from Africa, after a daughter of a president? So it was perceived as something that was undermining African Americans to call an animal after an important African American, and eventually the zoo actually decided to change its mind, and it called the animal a much neutral name. But yes, this is a way that zoos try and create that form of care that I told you about initially. They want the public to bond with an animal, and this is a way that the public bonds, and this is also a way for zoos to fundraise for their own institutional benefit, and also for conservation. So octopuses are, I think it was in one of the zoos in Europe, that people donate money for their name to actually be chosen. So it's a way to get the public involved, to get them to care about certain animals, and naming is a very important enterprise within the zoo as an institution.
It's certainly, and it's another fascinating sort of strand of it, and it's a really compelling read. It's Zooland, the Institution of Captivity. Iris Braverman, thanks so much for joining us on the Monocle Weekly.
Stephen Newland is a seaplane pilot on Queensland's magnificent coastline, and is in no doubt that the colourful, dazzling, awe-inspiring Great Barrier Reef is the finest natural wonder in the world.
I'd have to say, especially around this area here, the water and the scenery is just incredible. The Great Barrier Reef just changes every day. It's never the same.
There's nothing like Australia.
And guess what? You're listening to The Monocle Weekly with me, Adjutuck, and Tom Edwards. We're going to be talking about Arab theatre in a moment, but first a song, and this one is by Tanariwen.
That was Claire Etchell by Tanariwen.
With the current political climates of Arab nations, ranging from the calm of the UAE to the bloodshed being seen in Syria, the culture and politics of the region can never be simply defined.
But through the fog of these conflicts, it's important to remember Arabic culture is rich, varied, and for the most part, peaceful. Our final guest is the theatre director, Poppy Burton-Morgan. Poppy's gathered playwrights from around the Arabic world to create a collection called Arab Nights, opening at the Soho Theatre this week. She's here to give us a window on the contemporary concerns emerging in the Arab art scene.
Poppy, first off, we tried to explain in the introduction how this Arab Nights works. You've got several playwrights involved. You've got a few devices up your sleeves. Could you just explain for listeners exactly how the evening works?
Well, there's a frame story, frame device, which is the 1001 Nights, the Arabian Nights. So we meet a young Shahrazad, and she has to tell a new story each night or she'll be executed. So the beginning of each tale, we delve into six different worlds, six different plays written by writers from six different countries. So the whole thing is woven together, but it's also six unique stories.
So in the one night, do you see the six stories, or do you have to come back on six nights to see the six stories?
No, you see all six of them, seven in a way, all within the same night. So they're very short pieces, some of them 5 or only 10 minutes long, and some 20 minutes, but the whole play with all six tales is only 90 minutes.
And then the cast of playwrights, as it were, you've got people from Kuwait, Iraq, an anonymous writer as well. And how did you find all these different people to weave their stories together?
It's been an amazingly organic process, bringing on board the different writers to this project. Raja Shahadi, who's our Palestinian writer, I'd worked with him on a project in the West Bank in 2009, so he and I had a relationship already. But several of the others, kind of amazingly, friends of friends through Facebook and Twitter, and so kind of social media played a massive part in how I made these relationships, because we're not a huge theatre company, so we couldn't fly around the world meeting writers. So it was very much an email trail through friends of friends of friends and recommendations. And some of the writers I have never met and may never meet, particularly our Iranian writer, because he can't leave Iran. And we've managed to forge this incredible friendship through sharing photos on Facebook and Twitter and lots of late night emails and Skype phone calls and Skype.
I wondered about the sort of coherence then of the message, because we've obviously been hearing so much the last couple of years about, you know, the Arab Spring. We talk in these kind of generalities. And I think to a lot in the region, to many people, that's fairly unhelpful to be sort of grouped in that fairly arbitrary way. And I wonder, with this work, do you think that the voices, was there a concern that it would be fractured in some way? Or was that blend actually something that you felt would contribute to a better overall play?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I was really interested in the multi-author response to the uprisings, to the situation that's happening across the Middle East, pieces that spoke to each other rather than being written in isolation from each other. And partly the 1001 Nights Scheherazade frame story gives that unifying theme, and the writers engage with that theme in different ways, but there are threads that are woven through all the tales, particularly kind of drawn out by the actors. So although each tale, absolutely, there are different viewpoints, some talk about very real, true contemporary events, some of them are much more mythical and allegorical. But there is a through line of threads woven together.
Poppy, how long do you think it takes for an event to happen? Do you need some distance from the event before you can start reflecting on it? It's interesting because I think London has become very good at doing plays about quite recent things. You know, so if you look at something like the Tricycle Theatre, they were very good at actually just reading out the Stephen Lawrence trials or the Enron play that came on. We're picking up things that are in the news very quickly and they become plays and they become theatre. Do you think you need any distance, or do you think that there is a kind of theatre that can be really responding to events?
Well, I think the great advantage of theatre, particularly if it's on quite a small scale as opposed to something like film, is that it can respond quickly. I think a little bit of distance is helpful because there's a danger. No one wants to be seen to be riding a zeitgeist for the sake of it, or creating something in response to what feels like a hot topic for the sake of tapping into a hot topic. So I think a little bit of distance is useful, but the fact that these issues are still current is really important. And for us, that's why we've made this project happen more quickly than we might if it had been a production of Hamlet that could happen now or in 10 years' time.
I mean, obviously it's a challenge to bind these disparate elements together then to try and deliver this coherent message. I just wonder, we mentioned obviously your anonymous contributor. I mean, what are the specific challenges of that, aside from the difficulty just in communication? In terms of when you are going through the artistic process, is that must be very challenging to literally and metaphorically be so far apart.
It's interesting, the artistic process, because most of my work as a director isn't in new writing. So it's been a kind of journey for me anyway, working with lots of living writers rather than Shakespeare, who's a dead writer. And, you know, keeping in touch with them and touching base with them. And they haven't
none of them really have been able to be present in the rehearsal room. So how we can, it's finding ways of reaching them, videoing bits of rehearsal and emailing that to them, and again, Skype conference calls. So we sort of try to maintain all these connections, but it is hard, yeah.
Give us an insight into one of the stories. Give us an example of the kinds of things people can expect to learn about and to kind of have explained to them in a way that when they come to the theatre.
Well, it's interesting. They're very imaginative responses to what's going on. So it's not necessarily an education in what's going on in the Middle East. It's a much more... There's a lot of metaphor and symbolism and ideas of what the future might look like and ideas of hope and dreams. So it's a very... It's not the kind of show that you might see at the Tricycle, for example, that a kind of verbatim, factual, here's what it's like. There's a much more, imaginative, dreamy picture painted. But hopefully people will get a sense of some human experiences, some human stories of what it's like to be a protester in Tahrir Square or what it's like in post-revolution Egypt as a young woman and the brutalities that women face under that regime, the repercussions of that regime that are still being played out.
Do you think as a thread through these plays there's a sense of optimism, or is the prevailing feeling amongst the writers certainly one of what more frustration, I guess, fear? The situation on the ground has been so challenging that, you know, I would worry that if I was a creative mind, I'd just be worried that all these terrible sort of experiences I witnessed would sort of cloud my ability to plot a path that was optimistic or uplifting. But do you think there's still enough of a thread there?
I think there is a thread of optimism. I think partly, again, the diversity of the writers and the diversity of the stories, the experiences of different individuals have been and groups have been so different in different countries. So there are several that focus on Egypt and the uprising revolution there. There's one that's a very mythologized allegory of an unnamed North African Arab country. So that... although there's a kind of sadness at the core of that, that can be much more playful because it's not taking anything literal as its kind of inspiration. And then there's a Syrian piece, which is perhaps one of the most difficult because the situation there is still one of the most difficult. But I think the writers and the whole creative team and myself have absolutely tried to create a work, the whole work of theatre, that is inspiring, uplifting, and not simply 90 minutes of bleakness and horror, because that doesn't make for an entertaining night out.
And just tell me, it's interesting doing something that is so plugged into current events in a way, and not that it should matter, but do you think that oddly these plays will probably have a quite a limited shelf life in a way, that actually if you tried to do the same plays in 2 years' time, they would seem like history pieces? Do you think that these you will ever see them done again? Do you think that they have, and that's not a criticism at all. Do you think there is actually a time and a place for writing that lives and blossoms in one moment, and that's its life?
That's a really interesting question. Someone else asked me that the other day, and I think...
Oh, I don't want to be copying other people's questions. I like to be original.
But I think there is an extent to which some of them name very specific events, name and date and place them very specifically. And you think, if we come back to this in 5 years, does it become a period piece? Is it like reviving Carol Churchill's Top Girls 20 years later? I think the frame story and the 1001 Nights thing creates something actually much more potentially permanent and long-lasting. And I think we could revisit them, and it might be that we'd revisit them and commission new pieces in addition that would then be current for that time. But it also might be that with a few tweaks, they could become much more universalised.
Absolutely, the best of luck with it. And I'm sure it'll be a tremendous success. Poppy Burton-Morgan, thanks very much for coming to talk to us about it on Monocle Weekly.
Thank you.
We've done some serious stuff today, Tom. I think, and good music as well. I particularly like Clare Atchwell.
That was one of my favourites. Tenori one. They're always first when I'm reaching for a disc.
I think they're both good tests for anyone who wants to get into the world of radio.
It's a tough one to master, but you did it very well. You, and, you know, just absolutely, bang on.
Now, What's in the week ahead for you?
Where to start? I'll just be full of industry, you know, with all of my regular Monocle 24 endeavours.
I'm going to Berlin for a day.
For a day?
Yes, for a day trip.
Oh, that's nice. What will you be getting up to over there?
Okay. I agree with our art director, Richard Spencer Powell. We have a very exciting publishing project in the pipeline.
Wow.
We've got quite a big pipeline, actually, and it's quite chock-a-block.
I was going to say, it's always something.
It's like a Saudi pipeline at the moment.
Arriving down the pipeline.
Yes, I've got that. And then...
I love Berlin. It's a great city.
Yeah, I went for... we went for The Urbanist, and we did a story about Auguststrasse. Go back to the player if you want to find that episode.
I remember that one. That was particularly good.
Yeah, it was good. So I know that street very well because I was on that one street for 2 days. But yeah, I like Berlin. Although it does get a bit nippy at this time of year.
Oh, it's going to be brisk, as my elderly white-haired grandmother would say.
And as we would say as well. Well, I guess we should let people get on with their Sundays then.
It's only right, isn't it, at this time of day?
Okay. Are you going to say goodbye to people?
Why not?
Okay, you lead the way and then I'll follow.
Well, indeed, that is all from this edition. Number 176 of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall and our studio manager was Toby Hemmand. We'll be back next week. But for now, from me, Tom Edwards.
And me, Andrew Tuck. Goodbye.
Goodbye.